Welcome everybody. The new year is around the corner. In Tibet, we usually end and welcome the year, the new year, with a lot of ceremony and rituals, except the Tibetan New Year is not happening right now, the Losar. Maybe there's still 2 more months before we celebrate the Tibetan New Year. We conduct all this ceremonies as a sacred means to remove obstacles, or barchet in Tibetan language. The Tibetan Buddhists have this concept, the outer obstacles, inner obstacles, and secret obstacles. Usually these monasteries will perform all sort of rituals, and they invite the lay community to witness them. Also they invite the lay community to go inside to pray, hold the aspiration and the prayer to remove those obstacles. And then after the celebration of New Year, the lay community will invite lamas, monks and nuns to perform pujas or ceremonies for them in order to remove and reverse obstacles. They also often chant this particular Mahayana Sutra, known as the Heart Sutra, and they chant that many times. And then after chanting the Heart Sutra many times, sometimes they will clap their hands 3 times, as a mudra, as a gesture of removing all the obstacles. Sometimes when I lead a meditation retreat, at the beginning I chant the Heart Sutra in Tibetan language and clap my hands 3 times with the aspiration, and that we all will have the power and the strength to remove those obstacles. The outer obstacle is quite easy to understand. Illness, tragedies that we run into are outer obstacles. Imagine that you are driving somewhere, middle of nowhere, and then suddenly you got a flat tire. That is an obstacle. And that is considered an outer obstacle. And then there are inner obstacles, which is a very interesting idea. And then there are even secret obstacles. And these are more internal issues that we cannot comprehend easily. And that requires sometimes a deep self-inquiry, reflection to bring about light of awareness of them. And that's why they are named the inner and the secret obstacles. The obstacle here means the forces that hindrance, and that hold us back from actualizing our highest aspirations. We all have high and noble aspirations, and maybe sometimes it would be nice to write them down. And perhaps many of us are sharing right now the same kind of noble or high or the highest aspirations that comes from some deeper place within the Buddha nature or the depth of our being. And perhaps our highest aspiration is to change the world, or to change oneself. Or maybe our aspiration is to live our life fully, or to find unconditional happiness, or to manifest and actualize your potentials in this very life, or maybe to heal your inner wound. And yet there are all these forces hindering our aspirations to become real, to become actualized. And here we are not going to worry so much about the outer obstacles, because they are very easy to understand. That's why they're called the outer obstacles. And then the inner obstacles and secret obstacles are much subtler. We can't actually figure out them unless we go away and to be in a solitude and to observe a discipline like silence, and then engage with a deep reflection, and then finally this opening takes place in our psyche, and we begin to see all these layers of internal obstacles holding us back from actualizing our aspirations. This is what a journey is all about. Every spiritual retreat is a form of a journey, form of a pilgrimage. In the East, sometimes we go on pilgrimage literally as a both outer as well as also inner journey. When I was young, I had a chance to be on the pilgrimage. We had to walk for days and days to pay visit to this particular holy site in eastern Tibet, a temple that enshrines the image of Avalokiteshvara, the Buddha of compassion. This sacred image is surrounded by lots of stories and legend, and that's why it attracts lots of pilgrims from everywhere. In my hometown in eastern Tibet, everybody pays a visit to this particular temple once in their lifetime. When my relatives told me that they are going to be on the pilgrimage and to pay a visit to this holy temple, I was very excited and request them to take me along with them, which they accepted my wish. I was really excited. I couldn't even fall asleep for nights. I was so enthralled and ecstatic. And then, as we started walking together, and I felt sometimes very exhausted and tired. And then also, I remember that there were many conflict between people, possible trouble together, miscommunication, infight, especially when you get tired. Everybody has very short temper. After a while, my pilgrimage wasn't that holy as I thought. My idea was that the pilgrimage is going to be so holy journey that we're all going to be really holy and nice towards each other, constantly embodying love, peace, but it turned out to be actually the other way around. Everybody become mean at one point towards each other, and then somebody would tell you, today you're supposed to cook, I cooked already yesterday. And then we had one yak we brought, and everybody was fighting over the yak because when you get tired, you can ride the yak. So everybody said, oh, I'm tired, this time I'm going to ride the yak. You already rode it yesterday or this morning. So, and finally, we made it to this holy site in eastern Tibet. And anyway, I didn't really realize at that time that it was a very powerful inward journey because I learned a lot about myself. I learned my laziness, my short temper, my resistance, my selfishness, and my weakness. I actually learned about my own shadow more than I wanted to know. So that the whole journey was in many ways a little bit unexciting or even painful, a journey into world of my own psyche, my inner world. So every spiritual retreat is a pilgrimage. Even though we are not walking together, this is actually a pilgrimage. We are all travelers. This is why when Buddha defined Dharma, or the spiritual path, by saying, there is a going away from that as a condition to become made into that as unconditioned, unbecome, unmade. So he's actually saying that the spiritual practice is a form of a journey. Just like the pilgrimage I took. It's not really so much that we're going somewhere. It's not so much that we're really going from finite into the infinite, from ordinary to the divine, but it's more this endless exploration, this endless discovery of who we are. This is why all the ancient adepts said that if you want to be really free, you have to know yourself. The knowing self sounds very sometimes inviting because we hear these wonderful teachings and messages from also great saints and mystics that there's a divine in each of us. And if you keep exploring who you are, someday you're going to realize that the divine within you, you'll realize that you are this extraordinary entity. One time I have a friend and who told me that her practice is to just recite this phrase every day, I am that. She said, this is my practice, my mantra, what do you think? I said, well, this is really good, but there is no such thing that. And then she said, really, there is no that? I said, there is no that. When you say I am that, there is no that. And she was a little bit disappointed. And she was thinking that there's a that she's going to realize. And then someday she's going to realize that she's the that. Maybe there's that. Somehow I just teased her to let go of her attachment to the idea that someday she's going to wake up and realize that she's that. So for me, this pilgrimage is not so much that we are going somewhere and to the divine or to the infinite, or maybe one day we're going to come across this extraordinary awakening through which that we realize suddenly that we are the divine. But it's more lifelong, endless, sometimes painful, sometimes extremely rewarding journey on which we go through many sarga stages, and each time we go through these stages, we know something about ourselves that we didn't know before. And especially we become aware of these inner or secret obstacles hiding ourselves. And seeing our inner obstacles is actually the key to the liberation. And sometimes this is what really true awareness is. All the problems, the struggles, the misery that we are going through in our own life, as well as and those who are witnessing this world, is really coming from some kind of unawareness. And that's why when Buddha did this deep reflection to trace the root of human suffering to all its origin, what he come up with is this notion, avidya, which means unawareness. Unawareness can be, of course, defined in many ways. It all depends on the scope of your thoughts. Some people might define unawareness, avidya, as that forgetfulness of our true nature, or lack of realization that we are all one, and so forth. But to me, the unawareness is that we don't see our own limitations, we don't see our own shadow, our own neuroses. That is the unawareness, which is the root of all our suffering. And there's a lot of unawareness. There's indeed a collective unawareness, which is explained by Thomas Merton. He said in one of his writings, most of the world is either asleep or dead. Religious people, for the most part, are asleep. Irreligious are dead. So his statement is a little bit actually unsettling. He's saying that there's this all-pervasive collective unawareness that we all share, not just people who don't meditate, people who don't call themselves as spiritual, but even those who identify themselves as religious, spiritual, and so forth. And somehow or another, we are all part of that collective unawareness. So when we sometimes look around, we see there's so much suffering, pain, more than we can even actually comprehend. And then when we look inside, we also see, and more, there's so much suffering, and also there's so much neurosis in ourselves too. Let me give you some analogies, maybe even stories to describe the magnitude of unawareness that we all share, as well as also the suffering, the pain, all the neuroses that we all have somehow or another as a result of this shared, collectively shared unawareness. First, I'm going to share, tell you a story of Avalokiteshvara. It's a very famous legend. And you don't have to take this legend literally. You can take this as a more metaphorical story. Avalokiteshvara, the Buddha of compassion, when he was a bodhisattva, he made this strong vow that he's going to liberate everyone in this universe. And he vowed that he's not going to take the eternal rest or the eternal vacation until he liberates everybody in the universe. And then he stayed with his noble commitment. He came to the universe and he just liberated everybody. And then he thought, now there's nobody in the world, everybody is enlightened. He decided to take the eternal rest. When he went back to his world, the Potala, his paradise, he looked back and he noticed suddenly that the universe is full of all these lost souls, more than ever. And then he came back, he liberated all these souls. And then he went back, he thought, now there's no more soul. All the souls are liberated. And every time he thought, he finished his work. The universe, the whole world is full of all these lost and confused and painful souls. And he did this 6 times and finally he got really exhausted. So exhausted that he lost his precept, his commitment. And the legend tells that by the power of breaking his sacred vow, his body fell apart into many pieces. And then he was experiencing this pain and agony. And then suddenly the Buddha Amitabha, the Buddha of infinite light, appears and blessed him. And so this broken Avalokiteshvara rose up and manifested into different forms of Avalokiteshvara, including the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. And he then decided to stay in the world and to help everyone, to love and to embrace everyone, and not to seek some kind of eternal peace for himself. Of course, you don't have to take this literally, but this is a very beautiful story. It tells us that there's a lot of actually pain and suffering. The more you meditate, the more you open heart, the more you become aware of the sorrow and craziness of the world too. And then when you turn your attention inward, there's also sea of your own sorrow, your own neurosis as well. That's why one time Buddha was delivering a sermon and he asked his disciples, all the tears coming from your own crying, from feeling the sufferings from all these countless transmigrations. And let's say you put all the tears together, and then is that sea of tears bigger than the 4 great seas in this world? And then his students all responded with the same answer. They all said yes. And that sea of tears will be bigger than the sea of the 4 great oceans in the world. And Buddha said, now you understood it. And here Buddha is actually pointing out that when we open our heart and when we go inside, we all see there's indeed this sea of sorrow, and as well as a sea of neuroses or the kleshas. And this is the beginning of awareness, when you begin to really see what is inside. It's not really that difficult to acquire awareness or self-knowledge. Self-knowledge is in many ways very easy, even though it sounds very difficult. When somebody says you have to cultivate self-knowledge, it sounds really very difficult. Task sounds very esoteric. And yet, the self-knowledge turns out to be actually quite easy task. It's more whether you have a willingness to cultivate self-knowledge or not. I read recently this article, which is very much in harmony with the Buddhist teachings. First, let me recite this famous Tibetan proverb. It's also a Buddhist saying, which goes, "The only thing that is not mysterious and that is not hidden to your awareness is your own consciousness." Which means that your own mind, your own consciousness, your inner world is actually the most obvious thing that there is. This article was very interesting. I read it and have been quoting it because it's very much in alignment with this Buddhist idea that self-knowledge is indeed a simple task. And this article was saying that the consciousness is not actually that mystery. Even though we have this long-held idea, almost some kind of collective imagination that consciousness is like the most hidden secret, the most maybe unfathomable realm, only yogis, mystics, or the meditators have access to it, but not the common people like you and me have access to it. And this article says, actually, what is the most mystery thing in this universe is the matter, not the mind. That's kind of interesting. Usually we don't think matter is that mystery, that secret. We don't think this chair or this jacket is that great mystery. But there are actually mysteries from when you look at them from the point of quantum physics, they are totally mystery. If you just keep meditating, inquiring into even the secret of this very simple object like this clock, and eventually maybe you're going to come across a reality that you cannot comprehend. Maybe you're going to come across a transcendence, not through exploring your consciousness, but through exploring your wristwatch. This sounds very interesting. Doesn't it? And it is true that our unconsciousness is really obvious. This is both bad news and good news. The good news is that now self-knowledge is finally not so difficult. There's hope for the enlightenment. After all, we can all clap our hands and dance. But the bad news is that, and that maybe we are going to know our mind and who are sooner than we want. And it is true that actually when we look inside, honestly, we can't know what is going on there. Whereas if I look into your mind, I really don't know what is going on in your mind most of the time. Even though we always under assumption that we can kind of know what is happening in somebody's mind, I often lead a retreat and I sit in the front of everybody and now and then I end up kind of looking around and see what's going on and I see somebody's really grouchy and then I start forming the story, oh, this person having really difficulty and this person may be confused, should I help that person? And then towards the end of retreat, and this person would approach me and said, "This is the most beautiful retreat I have done." And I had all this amazing awakening, transformation, etc. And I tell myself, I guess I can read people's mind after all. Even right now, if we just pause and to turn intention and what, we kind of see what is going on. And maybe we end up seeing things that we don't want to see. A great Tibetan master, Lama Mupam, from the 20th century, said something really startling. He said, "One inward dharma is better than one outward dharmas." And that's quite an interesting statement. Sounds a little bit dualistic by saying that there is some kind of hierarchy within the realm of dharma. Especially for Buddhists, that's kind of shocking statement, because we have been taking refuge in dharma. We think that dharma is always noble. Dharma is always a perfect path. And here he's saying, actually, there is a difference in the realm of dharma. When he said outward dharma, he's not really talking about a particular form of a practice or tradition or methodology. He's referring to any kind of spiritual practice that is done without any kind of true introspection, without reflection, self-reflection, without really looking inward. And then he's saying that those spiritual practices have a very little power to change our consciousness. We can engage with the most beautiful, most sacred spiritual practices for decades and decades, but if we just forget to look inside of them, and those practices have very, very small impact on our consciousness. Whereas if we turn attention inward with the courage, with the honesty, and begin to journey inside and to bring about honest radical light of awareness on our own neuroses, our own misery, our own hidden habitual tendencies, and then our practice have a magic, have a blessings, and sometimes our practice can actually bring about even radical transformation. I'm not actually indicating that here we are just engaging these outward dharmas. I'm not actually suggesting that this is what we are doing, and this is actually quite an amazing community in my understanding. My friend and I coined this term Buddhist convention. In Asia we have really lots of Buddhist conventions. My friend, who is also a wonderful Tibetan Lama, his name is Kwambo Orgyen Chuan. He recently wrote a book called Our Persistent Mind. He lives in the Bay Area, and he's a very humorous person, and he and I coined this word Buddhist convention. Because we see there are all these spiritual gatherings in Tibet, also in other countries in Asia, where thousand people come here and there and here and there, and they all come together, and sometimes we just felt it was some kind of Buddhist convention. And you hang out with Buddhist people, you talk like Buddhist people, and you act like Buddhist, you see. You talk like Buddhist, and you hang out with all these Buddhist celebrities, and you do basically Buddhist thing. And maybe you'll find a Buddhist partner if you don't have a partner. That's pretty much it. We call it Buddhist convention. And sometimes there's not so much really real introspection where people sit and look inside. Actually, this sounds so easy, but this is not really easy. I will tell you, what you're doing is really difficult right now. I just want you to make sure that you give yourself some credit. Can you do that? What you're doing is extremely courageous. I'm not trying to make you feel good. Please don't misunderstand. I'm not trying to flatter you at all. This is the last thing I want to do right now, to flatter you, to make you feel good by telling, oh, you're all bodhisattvas. But actually, what you're doing is extremely courageous. And that might be kind of hard for people to understand from outside. Right? If somebody comes here, look around, what we are doing sounds really easy. We are just eating really good food, vegetarian food, and served on time. We are not really doing anything. We're just sitting and dozing off. It seems what we are doing is really easy. And it seems there are lots of other things that are much more heroic and much more impressive than what we are doing. But the truth is, this is not something easy to do for most people in this world. There's indeed this long-held, almost like an age-old cultural and almost like a human tendency, which is a form of resistance, a resist to the awakening. You know, sometimes I work with many, many people, and I often come across people, not only people, but even actually Buddhists who have really hard time to sit and to observe silence and to just witness what is happening. And many people have really hard time to do that. And sometimes people have resistance, and their resistance is quite obvious. They say, well, I don't like this. I don't like this practice. And some people have a much more subtle, trickier resistance. They say, well, I can do this practice, but I'm busy with another spiritual practice. That is much more interest than this one. More esoteric. Just sitting and doing nothing, observing your thoughts, it seems it's not so sacred. I'm doing something really sacred. And I can see that is some kind of really powerful resistance. But it's still resistance to look inside. There's a very interesting anecdote. Bhatra Rinpoche's life is full of anecdotes. Bhatra Rinpoche was an extraordinary yogi, and he was like the one of the most celebrated Tibetan saints. And there are a lot of wild stories, anecdotes around his life. Some of them are true, some of them are maybe exaggerated after he died. And one time, this sounds actually a true story. One time he was traveling as a wandering mendicant. Even though he was very famous, people had a hard time to recognize him because he was always in an incarnate as a beggar. And then he was traveling and ran into this yogi, this monk, meditating or practicing something in the cave. And then this monk didn't know this stranger was indeed this famous saint, Bhatra Rinpoche. And then Bhatra Rinpoche asked this monk, how long have you been practicing in this cave? The monk said, so many years, even I don't remember. Bhatra Rinpoche said, that's quite impressive. Could you please tell me what your practice is? The yogi said, tolerance. And then Bhatra Rinpoche pretended that he didn't hear, pardon me, what did you say? I told you tolerance. And then again, Bhatra Rinpoche pretended that he didn't hear, pardon me, what did you say? At that time, this monk lost his his coolness. He got really angry, furious. I told you many times I have been practicing tolerance. Are you deaf? Get out here. And the Father Rinpoche said, that's strange kind of tolerance you're practicing. And then he left. So many people indeed in the world practice a spiritual bypass. And actually spiritual bypass is much more popular than we think. And we can actually just practice spiritual bypass and to feel really good because we tell ourselves this wonderful story that we are walking the path and we are somehow going in the right direction and so forth. By the way, I'm not really indicating that this is what you're doing. I already told you are actually quite courageous. Because this is what we are doing in the end. In my understanding, we are sitting together as the pilgrims or the night travelers. And we are walking together. And we don't really have any kind of false solace that we can hold on to right now. Nor we have an illusory security that we can take refuge in. We are walking together, but also at the same time we are walking alone all the time. And we are meeting with our own new faces, and also we are exploring all these uncharted realms and territories within our own inner world. And sometimes we see our thoughts, feelings, other times we see something even much deeper than them, something we can't even actually analyze. So on this journey, we are going to allow ourselves to become aware of our own inner poisons, our own hatred, our own greed, our own attachment. And also we are going to become more and more aware of our own inner hindrances that is holding us back from living our life fully. Maybe this is perhaps the strongest aspiration for every human being, the desire to live a life fully, which is a very straight expression for me. There are no any kind of spiritual jargon in that. When we say, my desire is to live a life fully. And we all have, of course, a right to live our life fully and to find more joy, love, and to feel that this world is a friendly, to feel that our life is meaningful, and to feel that somehow we are in some kind of harmonious relationship with everything, with the people, with the life, with even difficulties. There's a way that sometimes we can feel we're in a harmonious relationship actually with everything, with even the difficult circumstances, even with the loss, even with the illness, even with the separation. In Tibetan tradition, there's a particular kind of practice which is about changing your perspective on everything. And sometimes we call it the way to bring all conditions on the path. And many Tibetan teachers wrote inspiring poems, verses on this particular practice, such as Ngochitome Zangpo and Zapata Rinpoche. And basically, the point of this practice is to change your perspective towards almost every condition that you go through in your life. And so you can feel that you're not fighting, you're not struggling, you're not trying to defend yourself. And you feel that there's peace inside you no matter whatever is going on in your life, in your external as well as internal life, but you are feeling that you're in this harmonious relationship where the very condition that you're going through today or right now in this very moment. And traditionally, there are these beautiful perspectives, point of view that we can memorize and learn, and sometimes we even recite those sacred aphorisms to plant those more enlightened point of views or the sacred outlook. And I sometimes sing these verses. I don't have to translate the whole thing, but there's one verse written by Gyatso Tomep Zangpo, a very well-known Tibetan saint, and he said, "I'm happy if I'm sick." And then he gave a whole reasons of logics and perspective why you should be happy when you're sick. It kind of makes sense. And then he said, "I'm happy if I'm not sick." And then he gave a whole logic, which is very easy to understand. And then he will say, "I'm happy if I'm dying." And he gave all these logics of why he's happy if he's dying. And they're very convincing logics. And then he will say, "I'm happy if I'm not dying." And he said, "I'm happy if I'm rich." And then he gave all these reasons why he's happy when he's rich. But he said, "I'm happy totally if I'm poor." And then he gave a whole lines of logic reasons why he should be happy when he's poor, and which totally makes sense. And the idea is learning how to be in harmonious relationship with all circumstances and all human conditions which are unpredictable and they're always changing constantly. You know, I don't have any kind of big claims like awakening or transformation, but I like to share a personal story with all of you, not because I want to talk about myself, but because I want to share this with all of you, so you know this is not just a theory. 3 years ago, I had this physical injury without getting into the detail, and then it caused lots of pain. And also, the pain lasted quite a long time, and there was sometimes even misdiagnosis about the whole illness. And I was told that my illness is a very dangerous one. And then with that diagnosis and my also intolerance of pain, because I have never been sick for a long time in my life. My body has been actually healthy all along, and suddenly I was having a hard time to walk, and then with all this information coming from outside, I told myself that maybe my life is finished, the life that I knew, and then I start just going into this kind of dark place in my mind and envisioning all these worst scenarios about my future. And then that was very difficult for me. But now and then, I taught myself, well, I'm going to surrender. Maybe I can't do anything. I have to surrender. And there are some moments I felt that I was actually quite happy. I was actually truly happy a few moments, and it didn't last long time, that happiness and comes and goes. But there were many moments I become kind of carefree, reckless inside. I said, I really don't care so much anymore. I'm going to just surrender to life, and I'm going to let all my hope and fear die, and just to live the life and with an open heart. So I'm not saying that I gained that kind of joy all the time, but that visited me, and I think that visited all of us periodically. You don't have to be meditator to have those kind of really very amazing, inspiring visitation from random insights, joy, freedom, awareness. So here, perhaps when you are meditating, naturally you see that you walk on this really amazing inward journey, and you feel that you are literally exploring all these different parts of yourself. You see your own thoughts, your emotions, and you see your also mental tendencies. One time I asked somebody, this Dharma student in my community, because I was curious about kind of the thoughts and feelings that people go through. I kind of know what I go through. I'm pretty much sure the kind of thoughts, the feelings that I go through pretty much every day. And then sometimes I'm also curious about what other people go through, because as a teacher I want to understand more about other people and what goes on in their consciousness. And I asked this person, this was just a few months ago, what kind of thoughts you go through and what kind of thoughts actually you wake up early morning, and this person says, the thought that always pops up in my mind, I don't like my body. And that's very shocking, but maybe it's true that many people wake up in the morning with this thought that I don't like my body. And you can see that we can actually develop this thought into some kind of mental tendency that keeps repeating itself again and again, from day to day, month to month, year to year, even decades to decades. And many people may actually live with this thought and die with this thought unless there is some kind of awakening, unless they start actually practicing path of inquiry and true reflection. And it must be really painful to wake up every morning with this thought. Recently, I was teaching in South Korea. We had those very one-on-one, heart-to-heart interviews, meetings with many people, and lots of people shared their deepest sorrow. And lots of their suffering has to do with actually self-loathing and self-hatred. They don't like their body, they don't like their career, they don't like who they are, and some people feel that there's something wrong with themselves. And yet, when we really look into the very much the foundation of all this neuroses, what we found is just unawareness. That's all there is. And we began to see the illusory nature, the falsehood of all these neuroses, these concepts, the believers, ideas that we hold on to dearly. Ideas about life, world, universe, ideas about who we are. So in the practice, we become more and more aware of our mental tendencies as well as their foundation, which is actually unreal, which is illusory. And then, and maybe once become aware of them, we realize that we don't have to feed them. All our pain, all our suffering, including our self-loathe and self-hatred, actually they will die, they wear out by themselves if you don't feed them. The truth is that we are always feeding them. In some sense, actually, we are feeding them. You know, sometimes they say in Buddhist teachings, you can be your worst enemy, and this is kind of hard logic to figure out. But it can make sense when you look from that point of view, because we are the one who are actually feeding our own sorrow, our own suffering. We feed them with unawareness. Whereas if we start to bring about more and more awareness into them, we really don't have to do anything then sometimes. We don't have to go to India to jump into River Ganges and say, oh, now I'm purifying my vasanas. We really don't have to do anything because awareness itself is the ultimate sadhana, the sadhana of all the sadhanas. Because what is happening in the awareness, no forces are feeding our neuroses, and they are actually going hungry, literally. And step by step, they are dying. They are wearing out. And this is nice news, isn't it? Thank you, everybody.